Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
Morgan Jerkins has been defined for much of her life as a kind of outsider. She's a Black woman who had never lived in a predominantly Black environment until she moved to Harlem, where she found herself having to rethink assumptions about Black culture that had been shaped by history lessons in majority white schools. She was raised to be docile, in a way, respectable, deferential to men, and on guard against explicit expression of her sexuality. It's not that Jerkins enjoy those moments of not feeling like she fit in, but being on the outside of things can provide a clear perspective on what they really look like. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Morgan Jerkins is associate editor at Catapult. Her new book is called This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. She joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Morgan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You take pains to say that you understand this is your experience of Black girlhood and womanhood, not a universal explanation. That said, what did you feel like you could illuminate just by laying bare your own experiences for other people to read, knowing that anybody who writes her own story is vulnerable to being judged or misunderstood?
Right. So I will just say that at the end of the first chapter of my book, I make it clear that my story is not a one-size-fits-all story. And I don't know if you're familiar with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's speech called The Danger of a Single Story. Mm-hmm. And what it says is, like, you know, we expect, particularly from marginalized people, that when they say their story, it's supposed to be universal. And for me, I had to make it clear, but I also had to tell myself as a writer and as an author, I had to surrender. Once I spoke about these very vulnerable topics like the tension between my sexuality and faith, my labiaplasty, bullying, self-hatred, people had to be allowed to think whatever they thought about these stories. But what I hoped to illuminate for readers, particularly those who do not identify as Black women, is to show and demonstrate that a lot of times when you're growing up as a Black girl and as a Black woman, you're not conditioned to be the center. Your experiences are often erased, often in your day-to-day life, particularly when it's with microaggressions. You second guess yourself and you second guess how you feel. And so I wanted to magnify those moments and show how I, as well as other Black women, do not exist in a vacuum. And we get these signals, whether they're implicit or explicit, that you should shrink mm-hmm. in order to make others feel comfortable being around you.
You say that when you were 10 years old, you discovered that you were Black, which I gather doesn't mean that you realized that you had dark skin and other people had light skin. Talk about what was wrapped up in that discovery that you were Black and that it meant something that you didn't have control over.
Well, with that particular story, I was trying out for the cheerleading squad. And at that time, when I was a kid growing up and seeing cheerleaders, all the cheerleaders at my school were white. And also when I was watching TV shows, for example, and movies, the center or the girl that everyone wanted to be with was a white female cheerleader. And so while I was trying out for this squad, I noticed that it was only me and a handful of other Black and brown girls who were trying out. And none of us made the team. And I remember vividly that my mother was talking to another Black woman whose daughter tried out for the team as well and said, you know, they were going to talk to the administration about this, but they never said what this meant. And then what I found out later on was when I was getting into an argument with a friend of mine who was a girl of color, and she said, you know why you didn't make the team? It's because monkeys like you don't make the team. And there had been rumors that her family was racist, but when she likened me to a monkey, it felt like an explosion on the inside, because it made me think about my identity in a different way and in a very oppressive way.
So discovering that you were Black was really the discovery that you couldn't have everything that white girls assumed they could have.
Pretty much, yeah. And uh-huh. that when I tried to be in these spaces that were not traditionally meant for me, someone was going to remind me that I was less than.
Mm-hmm. Your impression also was that, like, you had to be strong in a way that white girls didn't, because the world was ready to protect and support them, whereas as a black girl, you had to be ready to fight at any time. That it sounds like such a terrifying realization.
Well, I mean, it was very interesting. You know, I think about the social dynamics in elementary school, junior high school, and it just felt different in the way that black girls were treated, whether it's by the administration, whether it's by boys, whether it's by our peers, in the way that we were often mistreated or misunderstood, and the ways in which we sought validation. It was almost like you just navigating different realities or two realities at once.
So from the moment you were aware of an interest in boys, you started to realize that there was a racial hierarchy in your school to the perceived, like, desirability of girls.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I'm going to start by saying kids can be very cruel, but kids do not exist in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. What they learn, they either hear from their parents and or they hear it from music or pop culture. They get these signals. And so when I started liking boys in junior high school, I would think about the ways in which I was treated versus another black girl who was of a different complexion than I was, the type of facetious or just downright cruel jokes that would be talked about with regards to the girl's skin color, the way that the guys would talk about girls whose ethnicities were Latinx versus those who were white. And I was thinking about the way they would label and the way that they would treat us with regards to those labels. And I was like, oh, it's vastly different. And I knew that even as a kid, but I just could not articulate it as well as I can now, because now I have distance from those moments.
As an adult, you've dated men of various races. It seems like the white men always remind you of how open-minded they are for dating a black woman.
Yeah, I mean, there was an instance that I talked about in the book where I was on a date with this guy. It was going very well. We were at some bar, I think it was Applebee's or something. And, you know, we met off of OkCupid. And the image that I had in the OkCupid avatar was me in a nice dress. And then I had, like, braids in my hair. And, you know, he told me that when he saw that image, he didn't see a black woman. He just saw, you know, a good looking woman. And I understand the intentions, right? It's always someone who doesn't have the worst intentions or bad intentions, period. But it really hurt me in a way, because I said, that's what I am. So did you intentionally choose not to see me that way because of distance or what? But in that moment, I did not bring it up because I, you know, as you said, I was conditioned to be docile and I didn't want to turn him off. So I just was silent.
I mean, it's funny to think, what if you had said to him, I didn't see a white guy. I just saw a good looking guy.
I think about it. Now I'm at this moment where I feel much more confident in myself, thanks to a strong support system and therapy. I think about all the things that I could have said to him, but I was just so nervous about if I voiced my opinion or counteracted with a rebuttal, then I would be seen as less attractive. That's basically the root of it. Just to not speak too much, because if I do, I'm going to turn off a guy.
So a lot of your coming of age seems to have included you recognizing the ways in which the ways that your mom tried to protect you were maybe not ultimately appropriate. She was, a great believer that you had to be really careful about how you presented yourself to the world.
Mm-hmm. Right. The thing about my mother is my mother and I have a very strong relationship. My mother, just to give a background story, my mother was the second black family on a block that was full of white people. She saw the Ku Klux Klan burn crosses in her backyard. And so when you see those sorts of things, when you experience those traumatic moments, you essentially pass down whatever you can to your kids in order to survive. And so my mother at the base level was trying to raise me in a way to be hyper aware of myself and my surroundings, and know that I don't always have control over the narrative of who I am, especially as a black girl and as a black woman. And also given the fact that we grew up in a tight-knit Christian community as well, that added another complex angle to this sort of child rearing.
So what is your relationship today to respectability politics?
It's still unraveling in a sense, because, you know, I navigate a lot of circles and a lot of parties and get-togethers where I may be only one of perhaps a handful of Black people. And I think about the way I'm dressed. I think about my mannerisms. And I think, why do I have to do this so much? It seems like I have to turn it on. On, what I mean is code switching, as a way to make others feel comfortable around me. And it's like, how do I keep peeling back those layers to feel like I don't always have to, masquerade or be another version of myself, because I'm afraid that if I am away with someone as I am with another person of the same racial group as I am, then it's going to turn them off. So it's a constant battle, I would say, because so many of the people who I talk to, the people I converse with, they're not Black. So it's always that fear of them not understanding or distorting the way that I act or I speak.
Do you feel like you're code switching right now?
Not really. Because we're talking about me. So I'm at the center. Right. Whereas when you go to parties, you're not. So when we're talking about my life and all that, I don't feel like I'm code switching so much anymore, because I have to be the center. There's no place I can hide, basically.
What kind of, when your mother talked about you being a fast-tailed girl, that's a term that probably some people listening know exactly what that means and other people don't. Will you talk a little bit about it?
So fast-tailed girl is a label that's basically a slut-shaming label. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm allowed to say that on air. And what it is basically a way to shame a Black girl. And from what I've seen, there is no Black boy equivalent to that, that has the same type of, it's not a pejorative term. So my mother was afraid of me becoming a fast-tailed girl, but I never got the idea of what a fast-tailed girl meant. Did it just mean a girl who, wanted to talk on the phone with a guy? Did it mean a girl who wore a skirt above her knees? Did it mean a girl got pregnant out of wedlock? It was so ambiguous and yet had this sort of titanic force upon me and other Black girls that grew up in my community. And what it does is, the harm in it is that it sexualizes or over sexualizes Black girls way too quickly. It also puts restraints on what their sexuality can be by calling them a fast-tailed girl. And it's like, I don't know what that is. I'm just trying to develop and experiment and explore.
You were always one of the smart kids in school. I wonder how that both fulfilled and challenged the expectations people had of you and your behavior.
Well, as a kid, I just tried to mind my business. I just wanted to get my work done and then go on. I thought I wanted to go to Columbia Med School because my father is an OBGYN, and I thought I wanted to take over his practice. But when I started to express an opinion, and that started to develop and blossom when I was in my upperclassman years at Princeton, that's when I started to get these admonitions from other Black women about, when it comes to dating, knowing that not every man is going to be able to handle me, knowing that I'm only going to attract a certain few because I'm so opinionated. When giving my opinion gave me so much life, and it scared me again, because I didn't want to make people uncomfortable around me, especially not men.
That it seems really hard to like take a big part of yourself and try to hide it.
Yeah. And I'm not going to lie. I tried, but that only lasted for a couple seconds because I can't do it. I can't.
My guest is Morgan Jerkins. She's associate editor at Catapult, and she has a new memoir out called This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Catapult Associate Editor Morgan Jerkins, whose new book is called This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. This is really interesting to me. Although you would like to be a mother, you say you're terrified of the idea of raising a black daughter who will have to fend for herself. So many people talk about their fears of raising a black son. What's most dangerous for a black girl today?
Man, I think one of the issues that's facing a black girl today is at the root is being erased. In more ways than one. I think about, for example, when we think about the Black Lives Matter movement, so many of the cases that we've seen were black men, but black women also suffer from police brutality, and the people who started the Black Lives Matter women were queer black women. I think a lot of times when we think about racism, it's always through, well, when it comes to towards black people, it's through a black male lens. And so it's one of those things where I'm nervous about raising a black girl, because I know she's going to feel that push and pull of whether or not she should speak up about experiences and not be gaslit for them. And how do I create an environment that affirms her when I know when she walks out the door, I can't always protect her?
Yeah, I wonder also if, you know, knowing it sounds like you have a great deal of empathy for your mother's attempt to sort of help you move through the world in ways that would allow you to be safe and accepted. They weren't always right for you. Do you worry that you might guess wrong for a daughter that you were raising?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm always wondering if I guess wrong. I'm a constant worrier. That's just me. I worry a lot. And so I'm always worried that what if I just have a daughter that just needs to be left alone? What if she doesn't need me like a helicopter? I'm afraid of being a helicopter parent, basically. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I do worry that I might get things wrong. But I also think maybe that's a part of parenthood as well, is you're not always going to get it right. Your child is going to have their own personality. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, doing the best you can, but also surrendering and letting them grow.
You mentioned that Black Lives Matter and the movement against police brutality has very much been seen through a black male lens. Why has American feminism treated white women's experience as the default?
I mean, there's so many reasons. But I think let's look at the legacy of slavery, right? I mean, white womanhood was put on a pedestal. Black women were not even considered human at that time. You know, the labor that they'd done, the violation, the sexual violation of that time was just immense. And I think when we think about feminism and women's rights, you know, white women have still been at the center. They have been, you know, their issues have been at the center. And it's always been a constant battle to say, hey, but feminism should also be for black women as well. So I think, you know, when we think of why is it that white women have been put on a pedestal, you have to think about the legacy of slavery, especially in this country. You have to think about white supremacy in general, and that also harms white women too. But yeah, I think that's what we have to think is the history of this country and who was considered to be human and who wasn't.
Is it possible, do you think, for the big tent of feminism to open up to every woman's experience, or does it make more sense where we are today for black feminism to be one thing, white feminism to be another, and maybe sometimes the Venn diagrams intersect?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think white feminists have to know what is going on with other women who do not identify as white. I think that is important that they know about these issues. But I also think at the same time, especially for, you know, say black feminists, some of them don't want to be called feminists. They want to be called womanists. And I think individually that is their right to label themselves however they see fit. But I also think that we should broaden feminism, but at the same time know that we can't speak for everyone. So therefore, I think about the Women's March, for example, you know, there were many women involved, not just cis women, but trans women like Janet Mock. And it wasn't just white women. It was also women of color like Linda Sarsour. And that is especially important that if we're going to keep having these conversations about feminism, we need to have women who are not white, who are not cis, who may not be straight, who are not able-bodied, and let them take the floor to talk about the issues that other people cannot because they experience them every day.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. First up is Hannah calling from Houston. Hi, Hannah. Hannah, hi, are you with us? Okay, let's move on and speak with Michael in Bedford. Hi, Michael. Michael, hi. Okay, we will. I think we're having a phone problem right now. So if you'd like to get to us, you can email think@kera.org, or you can go to Twitter at KERA Think. So you mentioned that you are religious. You weren't really interested in having a lot of sex at an early age. Talk a little bit about how those decisions played into the way you thought of yourself.
Absolutely. So growing up in a Black church, I was always taught about there's a book in the Bible, and it's Book of Proverbs, and there's a particular chapter, and it's 31. And it talks about a virtuous woman and talking about how she's worth more than rubies and all these things. And that almost singularly shaped my idea of what it means to be a Christian Black woman and a single Black woman in the Black church, because I was always taught of what I needed to do to fix myself, to prepare for a man, to prepare for a husband. But there was never a balance. And what I mean by that is, what does a man have to do to prepare for me? And so that definitely led into me sort of being obsessed with how I can keep changing myself in order to be desirable. And, you know, and so that definitely played a huge role into it, of just knowing, like, why is it that I always have to change? And is that really what is supported in biblical scripture, or is it influenced by misogyny in the institution of the church itself?
And which did you decide it was?
I think it's the latter. Mm-hmm. I think it's when you are in a church, and you are told as a woman that you have to do all these things to fix yourself, but there is no balance of how men need to do better for you, then that is straight up misogyny.
You write that the white beauty ideal was never formally taught to you. Talk about the kinds of messages that seeped in anyway, and how they have shaped the way you feel about your own body.
Right. So there was no one saying to me, you know, white women are more beautiful than you, white women are better than you. Rather, it was implicit signals that kept accumulating over time. So in the first chapter with Monkeys Like You, it was not making a cheerleading squad and someone telling me that I didn't make it because I was a monkey and because I was, you know, one of the few Black girls that tried out, and all the white girls, you know, only white girls got into the cheerleading squad. I was like, okay, well, that's implicit signal number one. It was also being in junior high school and knowing the ways that, you know, guys would talk about girls of color versus how they would talk about white girls and the way in which they treated us according to those labels. That was another implicit signal. Other signals that I get as an adult, and also someone who has been working in media and writing online for almost 4 years, is the ways in which, you know, certain beauty standards is not the same. So for example, what I talk about in the book, when I'm talking about Rachel Dolezal in the chapter called A Stranger at the Carnival, you know, Black women are taught, for example, when it comes to hair, that cornrows, things, braids are ghetto. But if, for example, you see one of the Jenner girls wearing that, then it's automatically chic. And that is one of the biggest signs that, hey, someone who is white, whatever it's seen on a Black woman, it's seen as degrading. It's not seen as good. But if a white woman does the same thing, then all of a sudden it's fashionable and in vogue. And those are some of the biggest signals that I've gotten on a cultural level.
Did any of those messages come to you from other Black women?
Wow. In terms of like white women looking better in certain things?
Somehow that being the standard of, you know, of desirability.
Oh, well, I mean, growing up, I've always been told there were certain things that white girls can get away with that black girls cannot get away with. And it wraps into growing up into the tight-knit Christian community and saying, you know, in terms of like sexuality, for example, I could not express myself in the way that a white girl could because I'm already over-sexualized just by being a black girl. And why would I want to add that extra pressure to myself? Or just in terms of like when we think of hair care, like more attention had to be suited towards my hair because my hair is not what's culturally seen as acceptable. And so, there were some signals that you have to do more to be seen as acceptable to go in certain circles that are not just black people.
You were given your first perm when you were 3. This is before you could make that decision for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I just thought I was getting my hair done. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know what was going on. I thought, okay, I'm just getting my hair done. And then, you know, I got the perm slathered on my hair and I was like, oh my God, it's burning. And then when I got it rinsed out and I got it blow dry and I saw how straight my hair was, I was like, oh, I guess it looks good. My mother and my mother's friends were like, you know, you look good. So I said, okay. And then that began a ritual of over 10 years, every 4 to 6 weeks getting a perm.
You point out here, and it's something I had not thought about, the word kinky has 2 definitions in English.
Yeah. So when we think about kinky hair, it's like, okay, kinky hair, you're thinking of someone who has coily hair, tight curls, thick hair. But also kinky can also mean, can have a sexual undertone to it. And if you think about the history of black women's hair in this country, there have been many regulations passed that try to restrict black women and their hair. I mean, think about the Tignon laws in Louisiana, where black women had to wear scarves over their hair so they wouldn't compete with white women. You think about in certain school districts where black girls would be sent home if they had a certain hairstyle because somehow it made other people uncomfortable. And so dealing with those that legacy and how its influence still reverberates even today is something that I'm very interested in, particularly when it comes to hair and how it has that sort of sacred element to it, not just in the black community, but across different diasporas as well.
Do you feel like once you sort of recognize and acknowledge that, does that give you an obligation almost in the other direction to leave your hair natural?
For me, it did personally, because I never liked looking at my hair unless it was straightened, unless it was hidden under weaves. I was not a person that liked my hair at all. And so, yeah, there'll be moments where I will flat iron my hair or I might wear extensions in the form of like twists or box braids. But for me, I had to learn what it was like to do my own hair, to see my own hair, to know what it feels like, to know how to wash and groom myself rather than put that care into someone else's hands. And I had to be aware of that insecurity and reclaim my beauty in that way. So for me personally, not for everyone, because, you know, I can't speak for every black woman. And when it comes to her hair, she's allowed to do whatever she wants to it. But for me, as someone who did not like my natural hair, as someone who did not even want to see her natural hair, it was important for me to just say, okay, I'm going to stop with this and just see what I can work with naturally.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Morgan Jerkins. She's associate editor at Catapult and author of a new memoir called This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this experience that you had of you met a Russian person who was an admirer of your writing. They ask this question that sort of distills the extent of what many white people just don't get or refuse to get about your experience as a woman of color. Will you tell us that story?
Absolutely. So the person was Polish.
No, Polish,
and it's okay. So we were at a lunch table, the dinner table or kitchen table rather. And the person asked me, you know, why do you call yourself a black woman when you can just be called a human? And again, the intention was not bad. The intention was just, I'm just inquiring, why do you have to add these labels when you are human? And from a black woman's perspective, it is so hard and so distressing to get that question, because it makes it seem like when you are not a human if you say you're a Black woman, or somehow that erases your humanity or negates it or undermines it. So I loved what you said in the intro about, you know, the default human is white, because that's what that question reinforces. And it was so hard because I didn't want to offend that person, because that person is not an American. They have not, they weren't born and raised here. But it also was like, I want to explain in fuller detail why it is so difficult, especially for Black people who rub shoulders with white people a lot, to get that sort of question, unpack what it means.
So how do you answer and stay polite enough to, you know, continue sitting over the same dinner table?
Well, I said to that person, you know, I am a human, but I'm also a Black woman, and I'm confident in that because that's who I am. And I don't feel like I need to pick and choose certain labels. And I just left it at that. I mean, I smiled. I took a breath and ate a little bit of my salad and just gave them that answer in a way that, you know, doesn't make them hide, you know, because a lot of people are sometimes afraid to ask these certain questions. But I had to let them know, like, this is who I am. This is what I'm proud to be. And I don't feel like they're at odds with each other.
All right, let's talk about Black girl magic. You're ambivalent about this. First of all, for people who don't know the term, can you explain what Black girl magic means?
Absolutely. So Black Girl Magic was a movement that has begun, and basically what it's showing is the wonders of being a Black girl, the achievements that Black girls and Black women strive for, they accomplish. And I love the movement of the Black Girl Magic movement. I love it. What complicated my understanding of it was there was a scholar. Her name is Dr. Linda Shavers, and she wrote a piece in Elle about Black girl magic, and saying that, you know, Black girl magic reinforces the superhuman stereotype that Black women have been trying so hard to demolish. And the piece ignited so many strong feelings from Black people, including myself, because I thought, why is it that a movement that inspires so much joy in Black women would be criticized by another Black woman? But then I read another piece from her that had been published months later, and found out that she actually has a disability, a physical disability. And she talks about it a little bit in the Black Girl Magic piece. And I thought about it and I said, okay, I still stand by my unwavering support for Black Girl Magic, but I also wanted to bring up the fact that a lot of the accomplishments that we've seen of Black Girl Magic in media have been only Black girls and women who are able-bodied. And what does Black Girl Magic mean from a Black woman who has physical disability?
My guest is Morgan Jerkins. She's associate editor at Catapult and author of This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Morgan Jerkins, who's an associate editor at Catapult and author of the memoir, This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Morgan, as a young adult, you moved to Harlem, and you had to come to terms with the fact that you were both a Black woman in Harlem and a gentrifier at the same time.
Yes. One of the things that was the biggest culture shock of moving to Harlem was, first, it was a city. Mm-hmm. And I'm from a suburban town, a semi-rural suburban town. And so for me, when I moved there, I was like, okay, it's city life. But also Harlem has a rich cultural history, one that I only had a scant knowledge of. And so when I moved there, I was having a good time, but I was trying to get to use the ways of the hustle and bustle. And also trying to understand my place in being in Harlem. And I have wrote a piece for The Guardian about whether or not I was a gentrifier and what does that mean. And still to this day, it's something that I think about because I talk to Black people who say that there's no such thing as a Black gentrifier. And then there are other people who say, well, yeah, you could be a gentrifier because you don't live there. And part of the reason why you are there now is because of gentrification. So it's still an evolving conversation.
So how has it shaped the way you see yourself living? I mean, I don't know these days what the population of Harlem is like. Is it, I mean, is most of it still a majority Black space, or is that changing so rapidly that it's really just fully sort of diverse?
Well, I think that Harlem, it still feels like a very Black space to me. However, it is rapidly, and I mean rapidly, changing, definitely.
So is it disappointing to arrive there as this gentrification is happening?
No, because I think for me, like, there's still a robust community there, a community of Black people all across diaspora. I mean, I live on a block where it's populated by many Senegalese people, for example. There's still the Schomburg, which is like the biggest institute that holds all of these volumes from the African diaspora, over 10 million subjects, I think. And so there's still, I mean, even though it's, you know, it's definitely difficult when you have these increasing rent prices that drive out families who've been in Harlem for decades, which is very, very disconcerting and needs to be addressed. I still feel like there is a way for me to navigate and learn more about what Blackness means by being amongst all these other people.
All right. Let's give the phones one more try. We have Mike on the line in Bedford. Hi, Mike. Okay, I think that is not going to work for us today. If you would like to join us, we would love to hear from you. You can email think@kera.org. And we also have that Twitter account. It is @KERAThink. When you were younger and when you were in college at Princeton, I wonder if you deliberately chose books that would serve as a kind of pathway for you into what it would mean to be a Black woman in America.
When I was in college, I chose the most diverse literatures that had nothing to do with me. What I mean by that is I specialized in late 19th century Russian literature and post-World War II Japanese literature. So I was not reading anyone who looked like me. The languages that I learned, same thing. It wasn't even until I got into my MFA program where my advisor was like, here are the Black authors that you need to read. And then also another advisor said, you know, you're writing in a way that you don't sound like yourself. You're trying to imitate other people. You have to, how would this story sound from your own particular voice? And that revolutionized everything.
What was different when you started trying to find your own voice rather than imitate someone else's? How did your writing change?
The words came easier. Mm-hmm. I think when I was trying to sound like other people, like, you don't know how much time I wasted having a tab open with a thesaurus to try to find the most elaborate, archaic words to make a certain scene sound more beautiful. But when I started to write like myself, say, how would I tell this story? The words just flowed. There wasn't so many gaps and interruptions.
Who did you write this book for?
I wrote this book for many people. One of the people I think I wrote it for was for the girl I once was, the girl who probably would have needed this book. I think about I write it for my mother, who, you know, she finished the book a couple of days before my book came out. She said, I wish I was this brave. But I also, you know, when in the dedication part in the beginning, I said for you, you know, and for you, I mean, like, the general you, because I want people to read about this Black woman's evolution, albeit a messy evolution, you know, at a time where I wasn't so woke, so to speak, or conscious, and to hopefully give me the generosity to allow you to show this narrative arc while I'm talking about the ways in which I have found what it means to be a Black girl and then a Black woman living in America, and how I try to resist these sort of pigeonholing that I've had since I was a kid.
The other thing that I think is really brave about all memoirs, but this one in particular, is the fact that you have... Do you mind if I ask how old you are? You're in your 20s, Is that right?
Yes, I'm 25.
I mean, no disrespect whatsoever, but it's brave to put down where you are at 25, knowing that you might see the world in different ways or have come to understand things differently by the time you're 35 or 45 mm-hmm. or 55. And mm-hmm. I wonder if you just had to kind of close your eyes and jump and say, I'm gonna leave this thing here now, even if it's not the end of my own evolution.
Right. When I finished the final draft of this book, manuscript at the time, I cried and I felt so morose that I had to call a friend up and tell her. I was like, why am I crying? I should be happy. And then she told me, because you're mourning your former selves. Hmm. You have given life to these former selves in the written format, but you're mourning them. And so I know for a fact that by the time I get to 35, probably before then, that there are going to be many different sections where I'm like, okay, here's another layer there. I'm going to be in conversation with myself. But I have to also respect the woman or the girl that I once was at those particular times when I was sort of resurrecting them to write about these particular experiences, because whether or not they were embarrassing, they didn't show me in the best light, or whether or not they were triumphant as well, all of those former selves of mine, if you will, have brought me to this particular moment. And so I sort of give honor to them in a way by not trying to bury them.
You write about a girl that you knew in school, Jamira, and how she was mean to you and you fantasized about getting back at her. And you knew just how to do it. And you do write about feeling ashamed of that, because even though you didn't do it, what you considered was really about exploiting the way she'd be perceived, because she was also a Black girl, but a different kind of Black girl than you were raised to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Jamira was a bully that I had, like, bullied me almost every day. But we were not Black girls of the same. We didn't have the same life as, you know, most Black girls don't have the same life as one another. But that particular chapter was set up because in the beginning I'm talking about the monkeys thing. Mm-hmm. And so I already was conditioned to feel less than. And how did that turn out as I got into high school? A lot of self-hatred towards myself as a Black girl and towards other Black girls. So you would think that after a moment like that with the cheerleading thing, I would try to stand up more and being a Black girl, be more confident. It had the opposite effect. I was incredibly insecure. And so when it came to Jamira, even though she bullied me and I did not like her, the thoughts that I had towards her were damaging, just as damaging, because I knew that, you know, we didn't have the same social standing, where we weren't regarded in the same way by institutions. And I wanted her to be humiliated just like she would outwardly humiliate me every single day. And that particular memory, bullying, high school, that is the only time I gave myself the space to write about those memories. And it was incredibly hard because, like, it did not show me in a very nice light. I think, honestly, I mean, not to diminish what's happening, but if you talk about how you felt as a teenager, you're asking for some type of pushback, you know, because teenagers can be messy as they're mm-hmm. developing. And so I was worried about showing that part of me. But I also said to myself, you know, I'm doing a disservice to my readers if I only give them a sanitized portrait of who I am. They need to know about that girl. They have to know about where I came from.
Did you struggle with whether it had to be that story or you could find something else that showed you not in your best light?
No. Like, I think it's when I was even writing my book proposal, for anyone who is not familiar with the publishing process, when you're trying to get an essay collection acquired, you have to write a book proposal. Mm-hmm. As soon as I endeavored to write about being a Black girl and a Black woman, that memory immediately came to the forefront. It just rose to the top. It was actually insane. And I knew that I had to write about it because it was so vivid and it was pulsating that I said, I have to write about that particular memory.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Morgan Jerkins. We're talking about her book, This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black Female and Feminist in White America. We have a tweet here from Bev, who wants to know what advice you would have for white women who don't want to offend and are still trying to figure out white privilege.
I would say to read I mean, there were so many books out there that what it's like to be a Black woman in this country. You can read Pearl Cleage. You can read Audre Lorde. You can read Ijeoma Oluo, Brittany Cooper, and so many others, especially online. I mean, you can look at so many other essayists who or Black women essayists who tell you can tell you about, you know, the microaggressions or the bigger aggressions that they face. Also, listening. When Black women tell you about their experiences, if they open up to you in a way, it's not a time to say, oh, you might be overreacting or it could have been like that, because that's a form of gaslighting, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the thing is, like, there's so much literature. The great thing about this moment is that we live in a time where so many more books are being published by Black women, and they're there. There's so many sites you can go on, like Book Riot and the Huffington Post and Esquire and Bustle, that can direct you to these particular books. But also, if you do have Black women in your life and they open up to you, just listen and understand that they're dealing with a reality that might just run adverse to yours, but it's still real nonetheless.
You write about this book at the end of your first chapter. This book is not your resolution, but the continuation of your education, or maybe the beginning.
Yeah. So what I say by that is that my book cannot be the end all be all. It's not, and it never will be. But also for me as a person, I'm still alive, thankfully. And there are still things that I'm going to be learning. So therefore, even though the book ends at page 272, it's still a resolute. Because as you said earlier, when I get to be 35 or 45, there's going to be other things. There are going to be chapters in the book that I look at and I'm going to say, well, I can complicate this a bit more because I've lived more. And so what I wanted to tell people is that because I'm young, because I am just one Black woman, you cannot stop here with this book. You have to keep going on and keep absorbing these narratives.
Do you have a lot of interaction with people who've read your work on social media?
Yeah. I mean, social media, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Instagram. Mm-hmm.
What's been your experience with that?
It's been pretty good.
How's it?
I mean... I think, you know, in terms of, you know, people who get to me on Instagram stories, it's really nice to see people take quirky photos with my book. Sometimes people will message me on Instagram or Twitter or even on Facebook and tell me like how much this book meant to them. And thank you for being so brave. And it means a lot, because I think a lot of people assume that I was never afraid to write this book, and I was, but I just didn't let the fear paralyze me. So anytime I get a message from someone else saying how much they enjoyed it, then I'm like, okay, I can just breathe a sigh of relief.
Is there part of you that says, if I'm not at least a little afraid to put this thing down into words, then it must not mean very much?
Mm-hmm. Like I am from that idea that if you are not afraid to write something, then you're not pushing hard enough. And granted, I mean, maybe it's because I have like low key masochistic vibes, but like I that's the type of discipline I come from, especially when it's to a personal essay. It's like, if you are a little bit afraid of something, that's where the jewels are, and it's okay to access it, but don't access it unless you're ready. For example, in one of the essays, A Hunger for Men's Eyes, that was the most difficult chapter essay I've ever written. But one of the things there, when I talk about this experience with a guy I thought I fell in love with, I had been trying to write that section for 2 years and I could never get it right because I didn't have enough distance from it. So acknowledge the fear. Know if you're a little bit afraid, you're on the right path, but don't feel like you have to force yourself to jump before you're ready.
Morgan Jerkins is associate editor at Catapult. Her new book is called This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. Morgan, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and on Twitter. The Twitter handle is at KERA Think. The podcast is anywhere podcasts are found. You can also find archives of the show that go back years when you go to think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.